This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And on the line with us is former senior advisor to President Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, whose book, I understand, has just made the New York Times bestseller list. So congratulations, first of all.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm grateful to all my readers.
It's called Finding My Voice. And actually, you probably don't remember, but we met back in 2015 when you brought a group of reporters to the White House to push health care. And I got my first look at the Oval Office, and I got to sit and interview the president for 5 minutes, which leads me to my first question. I, of course, was in awe walking into the Oval Office for the first time. There must have been that moment for you, too, when you got there and you asked yourself, am I ready for this? So tell me what that was like.
Well, I do remember the first time I walked into the Oval Office, my second day of work, and I couldn't focus. I just kept looking around, and I was thinking, what is this girl from the south side of Chicago doing here? And I remember focusing on the ceiling, which is beautiful. I'd never seen photographs of the ceiling before. And it was a pinch-me moment. And I will say, I knew that for the next 8 years, hopefully, I wasn't sure at that point if it would be 4 or 8, but I knew I was going to just do my utmost best to serve our country and give President Obama the best advice I could.
It's different than visiting when you're actually in charge of the place. Do you ever ask yourself, do I deserve to be here? Do I have what it takes to?
Yeah, of course. I think everybody has self-doubt. You're working for the President of the United States, the leader of the free world. The good news is I had known him for a very long time by then. I've now known both the Obamas for 28 years. And so, in a sense, we came of age together.
So clarify what your role was. I think you kind of had a reputation as the Obama whisperer.
So my responsibilities were as follows. I oversaw the relationship that the White House had with our nation's governors and mayors and county officials, every elected official in the country other than members of Congress. I also oversaw the Office of Public Engagement, and that's the gateway through which citizens can engage with their government, a range of constituency groups, everyone who wanted to come in and give us their views about proposed legislation, policies, everything.
Now, one of the things that I noticed the president did from time to time was read the mail. Do you remember any examples of when a letter or an email that some ordinary person wrote to the Oval Office and fell into your hands actually worked its way into policy somehow?
Oh, absolutely. I have to tell you that we had a correspondence office that would go through thousands of pieces of mail every day and send President Obama 10 letters, and the senior staff all had access to those letters. He read them. He responded to many in handwritten notes back. And there was one woman in particular who a junior person on my staff discovered. Her name was Natoma Canfield. And she wrote a letter about having had cancer, and she went into remission, and her premiums went up because she had a pre-existing condition. And so she was not able to afford both her insurance and to pay the note on her mother's home. And she decided to look after her mother's home and let her insurance lapse. And lo and behold, of course, she got cancer again, came back. And so when you think about the Affordable Care Act, one of the most important components of it is prohibiting insurance companies from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions. And it was people like Natoma Canfield who brought that issue to light, and her life story really became our rallying call to explain to people why it was so important to pass the Affordable Care Act.
So the Affordable Care Act, how does it feel to see it being dismantled little by little?
Well, I worry about all of the families across America who will be adversely impacted by the steps. It's the first time in 4 years that we're seeing the uninsured rate go up. If it is repealed, 1 in 2 Americans has a pre-existing condition. And so what that will mean is that your insurance companies can go back to jacking up your rates if you have it. And it can be asthma. It could be women who are of childbearing ages were paying higher premiums. It can be something more serious where you need your insurance the most. We got rid of insurance companies being able to have lifetime or annual caps. So, again, when you need your insurance the most, you want it to be available to you. women who get preventive care, young people who get to stay in their parents' plans, all those families are going to be impacted if it's repealed. And so I think the only reason why it's still the law of the land is because people showed up at town halls the last couple of years and they talk about what it means in their lives. And I'm hopeful that with that groundswell of support for the Affordable Care Act, Congress will not take what I consider to be an ill-advised step of repealing it.
But there were still considerable popular objections to it even before Trump happened on the scene, where people felt that I understand that the reason the premiums went up in some cases was because this was real insurance, not, you know, phony insurance. But still, that's what people saw. People saw the price and decided that in some cases they were better off with the old system. Did that surprise you?
Well, look, in most areas around the country where there's competition in the market, you can buy insurance for as low as $75 a month. That's a very important insurance policy because one trip to the emergency room could cost you thousands of dollars. So on balance, I think there are 20 million people who have health insurance today that didn't have it before the Affordable Care Act, as well as all of the benefits that go to the general population that I described. So on balance, I think it is very positive. What did happen early on is it turned into a political issue where the Republicans were opposing its passage, even though it was modeled after the Massachusetts health insurance plan under Governor Romney, a Republican. So it should have enjoyed bipartisan support. And it's a good example, I think, of where they put their short-term political interests ahead of what was good for the country. And I'm not to say it can't be improved upon. We have parts of our country where there isn't enough competition, and the rates are higher than we would want them to be. But let's solve those problems, not just take it away completely, when, after all these years, I have yet to hear of a plan that is better, that covers people with pre-existing conditions. And so I think it's time now for the Republicans to lead and to say, this is what we propose. And if it's better, then of course we would support it. But they've had a long time to come up with something, and they have not yet.
Yes, and we know it's not going to happen until the next election, according to the president. Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward by Valerie Jarrett. Valerie, delight to talk with you again, and thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Valerie Jarrett in Seattle tonight, speaking at the New Hope Missionary Baptist Church. We spoke about a lot of other things, including Chicago, the violence there, and what she would do to solve that problem. The full conversation will be up on the Ross Files podcast later this morning. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colin O'Brien. There have been years and years of studies on eggs and salt. So we figured it's time to come to a verdict. Let's consult the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Let's start with eggs, Dr. Cohen. First of all, for a while, I remember eggs being condemned because of cholesterol. How do we look at eggs now?
Eggs are probably one of the most misunderstood, misinterpreted foods that we consume, because eggs are filled with cholesterol and saturated fat, all of which is in the yolk of the egg. And both of these were thought to increase our risk for heart disease. But there's been a number of different studies that have really given mixed information. So in one of the studies, they looked at over 37,000 adult men and 80,000 adult women for 14 years. And in that study, they found that eating one egg a day was unlikely to have any impact on heart disease or stroke. And in the past few years, there's been some other kind of important studies that have been released, one of which was a 2016 meta-analysis. And let's remind ourselves what a meta-analysis is. That's when somebody takes a lot of different studies and then kind of rolls it all into one big study. So they found that there was no clear link between eating eggs and the risk of heart disease, and that eating up to an egg a day may actually decrease your risk of stroke, in this meta-analysis, they said, by about 12%.
Wow, actually decrease your risk of stroke.
Yeah, but now there's a new study that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, and it involved almost 30,000 patients. And this study suggested that higher dietary intake of cholesterol or eggs increased the risk of heart disease and death. But if we look at it with a little more scrutiny, taken together, I would say that the existing evidence from studies over the past two decades would suggest that the risk of eating eggs is not really as dramatic as it may sound from this most recent meta-analysis.
what's considered to be, you know, eating too many eggs? Are we talking about an omelet every morning, an omelet once a week, an omelet once a month? What would it be?
Well, when we get down to it, it's the number of egg yolks, because the egg white is where all the protein is, and the egg yolk is where the fat and cholesterol is, and it's saturated fat. But that's also where some other important antioxidants live, and it's also where some other important minerals live, such as choline, and egg yolks are going to be one of the only sources of choline in our diet. So, you know, egg yolks are probably important. So these studies are kind of using a single egg as the cutoff. But a lot of people, myself included, eat egg whites, and egg whites are good because they have a lot of protein and they're low in calories.
What's a reasonable number of eggs to consume in a week then?
The goal is that 300 milligrams a day, or an additional 300 milligrams a day of cholesterol in the diet, may increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, a single egg yolk has about 185 milligrams of cholesterol. So if you're eating one additional egg yolk a day, then you're not exceeding that 300 milligrams, which was the threshold in this most recent study that was published in JAMA.
Okay, now I always salt my omelets, so let's talk about salt. What's the verdict on salt lately?
Sodium chloride salt is really important in our body, and our body carefully regulates the amount of salt that we have in our body. And fluctuations can actually lead to negative side effects. So it's important that we consume it. So sodium is involved in muscle contractions, and when we sweat doing exercise, it can contribute to muscle cramps in people who are doing exercise or in athletes.
Now, are you saying the salt leads to muscle cramps, or you need salt to avoid muscle cramps?
No, you need salt to avoid muscle cramps.
Okay.
It's sodium plays an important role in muscle contraction. And then chloride, which is the other part of salt, sodium chloride, is the second most abundant electrolyte in our blood after sodium. So what's clear is this. Salt doesn't cause high blood pressure. However, if you remove salt from your diet or lower the amount of salt in your diet, you can lower your blood pressure. So people who have high blood pressure could actually benefit by consuming less salt. Hmm. But if you're younger and you're eating salt, it's not going to lead to high blood pressure. One thing that has been shown is that high salt intake is associated with stomach cancer. And there is evidence to show that it may be because it increases the growth of a certain type of bacteria in our gut that is associated with a higher risk of stomach cancer.
Okay, so that sounds pretty serious. And how would you gauge what constitutes a high level of salt intake? Is that like fast food every day, or packaged food is notorious for having lots of salt?
That's an excellent point, that processed foods are the most abundant source of salt in our diet. So one of the ways to reduce salt in our diet is actually to switch from packaged foods to more whole foods. The bottom line about salt is this. It's an important part of our diet, and it plays really an essential role in our body. And in some people, too much salt can be associated with conditions like an increased risk of stomach cancer, or if you have high blood pressure, it can make your high blood pressure worse. So this is one of those things where you need to understand your body, you need to talk to your physician, and understand how much salt you should or shouldn't be taking.
Sounds like it's safer just to have a cup of yogurt for breakfast.
Yogurt's always a good choice, and it's low in salt.
Our medical consultant, Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
It sounds like the state of Washington is getting ready to welcome many refugees that Donald Trump wants to send this way. Let's go to Cut Radio's Hannah Scott. What's the latest on becoming a sanctuary state?
So on the same day President Trump threatened to start shipping immigrant detainees to sanctuary cities, lawmakers in Olympia took another step forward to solidify Washington's sanctuary state status as the House passed a bill that, among other things, prevents state and local agencies from sharing information with the feds for civil immigration enforcement, those cases that involve immigrants here illegally but who have not committed any serious crimes. Democratic Representative Lillian Self-Portes calling this bill a necessary protection for Washington's working immigrant community.
We want to make sure that they are protected, taken care of, and that they can thrive in our state so that our economy can continue to thrive. This bill is not about protecting any criminal. That is not what this bill is about. If you commit a crime in the state of Washington, you will be prosecuted. This is about making sure that we are not doing the job of the federal government without resources, but that our resources are being spent to take care of our Washingtonians.
Republicans, though, were highly critical of the part of this bill that prevents local cops from sharing information with federal immigration authorities, something Republican representative and police officer Morgan Irwin says is a threat to public safety.
Sharing information saves lives. It does. We've shown this over and over and over again, highlighting the role of immigrants inside Washington State and the value they add to our economy is beyond important. But the piece of this bill that continues to bother is the piece that says if you have information, you can't share it with federal partners. And when federal partners have information, then you can't accept it from them. And that's tough because things will get missed.
And Irwin pointed to the recent killing of Kittitas County Sheriff's Deputy Ryan Thompson by an illegal immigrant as an example of how dangerous not sharing information can be, a concern that was echoed by others on the floor, including Representative Tom Dent.
I was in Ellensburg, and I attended the funeral of a friend, of a family man, a community member, and a law enforcement officer. This was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was so devastating to me as I watched his one-year-old son and three-year-old daughter sit down in front of me, realizing that that young man will never know his dad, and that little girl will barely remember her dad. And this is troubling because we are a nation of laws, and we need to remember that.
But Democrats stressed that those who commit crimes would be prosecuted and that this was about making sure immigrants in Washington schools, in our agricultural fields and workforce feel safe and are willing to talk to police if they are here illegally. In the end, this passed along party lines and it now has to go back to the Senate, to which we'll have to sign off because of some minor changes that were made in the House. But it sounds like this will go all the way.
And the shooter of that deputy is dead.
Is dead.
So
yes.
He's not coming back again.
No.
So are they officially saying then that if the president does indeed decide to bus people here, we're ready and willing and able?
They actually, so this was already scheduled to be debated on the floor that evening of Friday, the same day that the president made those remarks. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hear the president's comments come up, only references to policies coming out of Washington, D.C., things of that nature. But this is, yeah, this is absolutely, and it's been the stance, especially among Democrats in our state for some time, that we are a welcoming state. And this solidifies this. This bill is called, I believe it's the Working Washington Act. It's about protecting the workforce, right. But it's also about the making sure that the immigrants are here and feel safe.
Okay, now on sharing information, when bad guys are released, all right, after serving their sentence, and it turns out they're here illegally, can that be shared with ICE? Because, I mean, if you violated the law, just because you served your sentence doesn't mean you deserve to stay, does it?
If you've done a criminal, if you're a felony, then yeah, absolutely yeah. You can share this. This is very specific to civil.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the other thing, though. Issues. If you're arrested for, like, DUI three or four times, I mean, I'd frankly deport some of our own people who get arrested three or four times.
No, yeah.
You, right? So if you're not here legally, could that information be shared and we could deport those people at least?
I would suspect not unless you reached that level of a felony, which, of course, we know is a fourth DUI. And there were some other things in this bill that the Republicans took issue with. It also creates a work group where the state attorney general has to work with people to come up with some model policies within a year to limit immigration enforcement in public schools, health facilities, and other places operated by the state. So there has been some pushback, but again, it does sound like this will cross the finish line. Another one that looks like it might cross the finish line is some pretty intense eviction reform going on in our state. This has led to some heated debate on the House floor. Essentially, this will extend the pay or vacate notice someone gets when they pay their rent late. So right now it's 3 days after you haven't paid, you get that pay or vacate notice, start eviction proceedings. This extends it to 14 days. The argument being that 14 days gives the tenant a little more time to come up with that rent and not end up out on the street.
So this is an attempt to address homelessness.
It absolutely is an attempt to address homelessness, as many of the Democrats said, but there were some big concerns on the Republican side, especially when we're talking about small mom and pop landlords.
We need to do something that favors the small operators, and this bill is not it.
For the folks that did have that one house that they were renting because it's the house they moved out of and into another one, if regulations get too hard, they just sell it. And so now we've lost a rental unit.
We are creating policy that will close rentals. Economic response to closure of rentals is less homes to rent. When you have less homes to rent, you have a housing crisis.
So they're worried it's going to exacerbate the current housing crisis. But we also heard again from freshman Democratic Representative Melanie Morgan, who had I shared with you before, she had been evicted. She spoke about it earlier in the session. She elaborated on that this time.
My family and I were evicted over $150. I had a Section 8 voucher at that time. I also reached out to the VA to pay the $150. The original amount was $50. $100 was late fees. The VA decided to pay it and gave me a voucher. But this landlord, this particular landlord, who is a small mom and pop landlord, decided not to take that because it was going to take 14 days for the money to be released.
So there's that argument for the 14 days. She goes on to talk about that she has a judgment and eviction on her record now, so she even still has difficulty renting a place at this point.
So has anything done to treat the small mom-and-pop landlords differently from the big ones?
No, there was a big effort. Lots of amendments came up from Republicans to try to do something for those landlords who have five or fewer properties. They all failed. So this is as is. It does a lot of other things that allows judicial discretion, so judges can consider life circumstances when we get to eviction court. Things like that. This also has to bounce back to the House or to the Senate, I should say, but I do believe this is likely to pass as well. A couple of other quick updates. We should see permanent daylight savings time. Likely, it was supposed to come up over the weekend. It's likely to come up today.
Yes.
Sounds like that has a lot of momentum behind it. Vaccine bills, getting rid of those personal exemptions, still in play. Have to get that done before the Wednesday cutoff period. And it sounds like car tabs are going down in flames.
Really?
Really. It has to get a hearing in transportation this week, and the sponsor of the bill told me yesterday that it doesn't sound like that's very likely.
You come back to talk more about that later this morning, because I have a feeling that people are not going to be happy about that.
Yeah.
Is there an initiative, by the way?
There, Tim Einman does have an initiative, $30 car tabs, yes.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Wash those scams away with a dose of kindness. A Pennsylvania man says he had no idea a simple interaction with a young boy could have such a big impact. Khalif Hill works at the front desk of a hotel. He was on a phone call when 13-year-old Colin Haas came in, didn't mind that he was on the phone, and asked if he could show him a card trick.
And I said, yeah, why not? I'm on hold. I can have time.
Well, they then spent the next half hour exchanging card tricks because Khalif knew some magic too.
The next night they came in from dinner. I said, hello, how are you? And I said, how are you doing with the magic trick I showed you yesterday? And he says, I can't remember. I said, well, come back out. I'll show you again.
Fox 8 in Cleveland says it was that act of kindness, just taking the time, that made such a huge impact on Colin. He has autism, and his mom says most people don't take the time or have the patience to interact with Colin. She snapped a picture of the two doing card tricks and posted about it on Facebook.
That post popped up, and I was like, oh my God, so instantly started crying.
It's a coincidence, too, that the hotel Khalif works for does special fundraisers during Autism Awareness Month, which is April. His manager says that's just who Khalif is.
I'm so happy that I was able to help, you know, make his day a little brighter, you know what I mean? Not realizing how I impacted it.
Ah, the beauty of human interaction, right?
Yes, right. And now our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is from 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. And this happened yesterday at T-Mobile Park.
The lineup and the pitch. Haniger is swinging a fly ball into left field. Brantley going back. Looking up. Goodbye baseball beyond the Astros bullpen.
So that was good.
It was They're off to a great start.
You called it, though. I mean, due credit to you. On Friday you said they could lose this whole series and you'd still be high on them.
Yes. The bottom did not fall out. They lost all three games to the Astros and they hung in there step for step. They gave up two grand slams on Friday night, which is unusual.
That was rough.
Yes.
Two grand slams is really unusual in a game, and were beaten 10-5, and then were 3-1 and 3-2 in the next couple games against a really good pitching team that's won now 8 in a row. The Astros are a great team. And at no point during this 13-2 start did I think that the Mariners were a better team than the Astros. And they played pretty well.
Yeah, there's they kept a lot the home run streak alive.
Yeah, the home run streak, it's interesting. this is not something that I woke up, God, I hope they hit a home run today against Cleveland. Because
really?
I really want this home run streak.
Come on, though. It's 17 now?
18?
18?
It's a statistical oddity.
It's fun.
It's weird. It's minutia.
Okay, fine.
It's for the record books. It's cute.
So who gave up the grand slams?
Well, there was one was the relievers, because Wade LeBlanc left with a pulled oblique. He's out 4 to 6 weeks. That's the worst thing that happened to the Mariners, is Wade LeBlanc, who actually found out, you know how his name's pronounced? LeBlanc.
Le Blanc.
When I saw that, you know, injury, that's when I go, uh-oh. You know, it's when the injuries start happening.
It's going to happen. These things are going to happen over the course of the year. Yeah, but man, yeah, who hasn't torn an oblique? Pulled an oblique.
Yeah.
I didn't know that I had
them. Snapping the one in.
You know what? I actually think that I'm immune from those because it's just fat, which can't be pulled. Yeah. So I'm bulletproof when it comes to oblique strains.
Good.
It was a good weekend. It was great baseball, and they came out on the wrong end of it to a team that has won one World Series and been to the American League Championship Series in the past 2 years.
I never felt they were out of it. So, I mean, that part felt good. So what do you expect from Cleveland
Although, man, Rick, the announcers love to say it, man, there's no quit in this team. Don't you want just once? Because if that's true, if this team never quits, there have to be other teams that do quit. And if somebody would just call it like, well, stick a fork in these guys. They're never coming back. Well, see, this is a cadaverous-looking team.
I remember.
Put them on the slab. Tag them.
Saying that, in fact. About this very team.
Yeah.
So, Cleveland, what do they look like?
Cleveland comes in. Cleveland also a very good team. They got Trevor Bauer, who is also. They faced a tough run of starting pitchers. It was Verlander on Saturday. It was Garrett Cole yesterday. And now it's Trevor Bauer today. Those are three of the top six Cy Young vote getters. In last year's, so it's going to be a tough matchup. But let's go! Come on, Yusei Kikuchi's on the mound.
Mm-hmm.
You say Kikuchi, I say victory.
Right. I say there's no quitting Kikuchi.
Yeah.
Is there any Kikuchi Koo corner yet?
No.
No.
I think they're worried
about that.
Yeah.
Everybody's over the wave. What about the Kikuchi Koos?
Yeah, I definitely over the wave. Did you know that I tried to stop the wave last year?
Did you?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I stood up and shouted and then like stood in resistance to it to try and one man against the wave.
Even as it passed you, you just stood up?
Yeah, I stood up and I tried to be. And it was about as effective as it would be if you stood in the ocean trying to hold your hands against the owner, John Stanton. I was with my in-laws at the time. And the owner, John Stanton, saw it. and more importantly, heard me.
I've been a wave buster before.
I hate the wave at baseball.
Yeah, so do I. I also hate it when you do it when your team's on offense in football. That just blows my mind. That's an unwritten rule. That should never happen.
Well, why would you want to do it when they're on defense?
Because that gets the crowd
going. The wave is an ineffective crowd noise generator.
Well, either way, but you don't want it when your team's on offense because you want it as quiet as possible. Whoa. At home, at least.
Yeah.
But I hate the wave, too.
Yeah. I'm okay with the wave. If you're going to do the wave, do the wave.
Can we talk about Russell Wilson? Because today's the deadline.
Oh, yeah. I'm just on pins and needles to see if the little prince gets his new deal.
Oh, man.
The clock is ticking.
The latest comes from him, and his agent is, they've told the Seahawks, if you don't give us a contract that we want by midnight tonight, we're never negotiating again.
What?
Really?
Yeah, that's what they've said.
We won't talk.
Right. Yes, that's what they've let loose through the.
So what does that mean if he goes on strike or what happens?
No. He's going to play and he's going to be with the team for another 3 years. But he said, we're never going to talk contract again. This is your last chance to sign me.
And so far the Seahawks have been.
Well, the Seahawks have given him an offer and it's on the table. And if he wants he can take
offer?
It. Well, they haven't spelled it out to me entirely. I think it is 3 years, and it's going to pay him upward of $105 million, and it's going to average probably right about 35 over the first 3 years. And I think that the overall, the back-end structure of it would be flexible to what he wants. The three-year payout, which is what most people would look at and gauge, is probably between $105 and $110 million.
Nice.
How that is guaranteed. It's the highest, it's the biggest quarterback contract for any quarterback for any player in the league. It's not a market-busting contract, which might be what Russell wants. And it's not something that changes the structure of the way the Seahawks
do contracts. Would that make him the highest paid?
It would make him the highest paid, yes.
Okay.
It's a market deal.
So until the next contract is up, and then that quarterback will be the
highest. But that's how it works.
Suppose he asked for an Alex Rodriguez clause, where if anybody gets more, he gets a dollar more.
Oh, geez. I don't think they do those anymore. No. I certainly wouldn't if I was the Seahawks. I'm not going to negotiate against other people's idiocy.
Okay.
Somebody could have a screw loose. No, there's no. But is it going to take an Alex Rodriguez approach? Because that's kind of what he's saying is if you don't give me the contract that I'm asking for, if you don't give that to me by midnight tonight, I'm going to head to free agency in 3 years.
Danny O'Neill, our sports insider,
God, I hope he gets
brought
contract.
To you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.
Whoa.
He is really worried about whether Russell Wilson will be playing
on
next
pins
year.
Pins and needles. No, he's going to be playing. He's going to play for the Seahawks the next 3 years regardless.
Going to get a contract, right.